Blog Talk Radio.
Because we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Bal Red Radio. My name is Matt Weston, and tonight I'm joined by diehard Chris, our long-lost friend who we haven't spoken to in a while on the show, and also BFD will be on sometime in the next few minutes. He's late as usual, you know, late to his own funeral, that guy.
Just leaving you out to take care of everything, isn't he? How you doing, Matt? It's been a while.
Yeah, I'm doing great. It's great to have you on. I know, if you think I missed you, the loyal listeners out there probably missed you 100 times more, you know?
Yeah, I just bet they do.
yeah, BFD's on as well, too. I'm trying to buzz him in. Hey, BFD, how's it going?
Yeah, y'all talking smack about me. I was singing along, man. I was singing, like, melody-type stuff with the Houston Oilers number one, baby.
Just said Deshaun Watson thing's gone to his head so much already. But in case you didn't know,
yeah, I was going to say we're gonna be able to talk to some old school Oilers for the first time ever.
Yeah, I sit there and listen to you two in your rocking chair while I sit on the floor cross legged. Whenever we get to that point, for tonight's episode, what we're going to do is we're going to review the Browns game. That was a lot of fun, and then you know there's no point to do a podcast if you're not going to squash some beef every once in a while. So Dyer, Chris, and I are going to talk Blade Runner for probably about 15 minutes, 20 minutes, 10 minutes. We'll see. I know he has a Houston Astros game to watch, and I have you Darvish to watch tonight. So, anyways, Chris, did you know that the Cleveland Browns are a really, really bad football team?
Boy, if I didn't, then I learned that just by having eyes on Sunday because, my God, I mean, I'm sure we were all having Oswald – I almost said his name. I left off one syllable. He who shall not be named. What are we calling him? The unnamed, the unspoken. Do we have a pet
redacted?
Name for him?
Yeah,
I don't know. I go name redacted, and then Pat goes unperson. But I go name redacted. I screw it up all the time.
Those are both solid though. I like unperson as well. So, yeah, if you aren't having redacted flashbacks watching Kevin Hogan throw the ball 10 yards out of bounds, 15 yards too deep. Skipping the ball off the turf, 5 yards in front of his receiver on an 8-yard route, and then you clearly, if you didn't feel little scars on your heart when that happened, then you clearly haven't been a Texans fan for long. Because, wow, I mean, every week we seem to have this. I think we're all sort of internally and externally having this fight within ourselves about this Texans offense. Like, yeah, they look great, but let's talk about who they played. You know, it's they're just the defense. It's just so bad for the Browns against us, and their quarterback situation was so bad, putting them in bad positions when they would have to punt. And it's a hard gauge, but yeah, the Browns are they're just an abomination, and it looks like they're going to have to probably deal with I'm going to call it fallout. It's not really going to be fallout because people are going to be probably ready to kick Deshaun Kizer to the curb in favor of whatever quarterback they finally actually draft next year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know BFD was upset watching the Browns play because he loves Deshaun Kizer. I really like Kizer heading to the draft. I still like him too. He was just the worst quarterback in football the first 4 weeks of the season, and while that's not his entire fault, the right tackle's been really bad. They've only run two plays the entire season with the lead on offense. So the two things they do best, stop the run and run the ball, they can't do either of. Kenny Britt is a complete travesty of a wide receiver. And he's completely given up once he got that contract, Albert Haynesworth style. And then Corey Coleman broke his hand too, so they don't have a whole lot of options outside. And it's been kind of frustrating, as a Kizer fan, because what you thought was going to be a nice quarterback situation has kind of become, really hellish really quickly for him. And so he still has the arm strength. You still see glimpses of it. But, he's just been holding the ball too long. There's accuracy issues still. But I didn't mind the benching as much as, BFD does and is going to say. But I think sitting on the sideline a little bit will do him some good, hopefully. And he'll start again either next week or sometime soon in the future. But BFT, how much did you hate watching Kevin Hogan play on Sunday?
Kevin Hogan was phenomenal. I mean, I made the comment during the Hair of the Doctor that he could have overthrown the UT Tower during that game. I mean, it's not that he was missing passes by a couple of feet. He was missing passes by yards, you know, multiple yards over dude's head. He was just terrible. And I go back to, at some point, right, at some point in time, if your starting quarterback is, say, Tom Savage or Brian Hoyer or just somebody who just, you know, is trash, at some point you just have to look at him and go, you know what, maybe I just need to give Rook a chance. And you give Rookie a chance, and that way he can go try to do something. Because the guy that you're going to play is going to be the 32nd, 33rd best quarterback as a starter. And I realize there's only 32 teams. You know, that's how bad he is. And so just give the Rook a chance. And it's just stupid to me that they trot out Hogan, who has no arm strength. He's just terrible. It's just a waste of DeShone Kizer reps. Even the practice reps, every rep that Hogan gets is a waste. It's just like the Watson Savage situation. So it really bothers me. It's one thing if maybe you're playing, okay, Alex Smith is my starting quarterback. I'm going to keep going with him because he's not bad. You know, we're going to let Patrick Mahomes sit. But it's something completely different if you're talking Tom Savage or Kevin Hogan. So, yeah, it riles me. It riles me, sugar.
Yeah, and I guess it's just one of those, like, you know, teacher situation, more philosophy. More like a philosophy trying to, you know, develop a quarterback with Kizer, because his play this year has been awful. You know, he's been, you know, worse in just about every single statistical category. You know, I watched the video. I ran out of time to write something on him because I was, you know, bad managing my time. But, you know, he wasn't good at all when he's been on the field. And so if you think it's the best way to develop a quarterback is by playing as much as possible, then you obviously should start him. If you think, hey, like I kind of do, where if you put him on the sideline, give him a chance to look at the game from a different angle, try to slow things down for him some, and then hope that maybe the quarterback situation becomes better late on the year, that's fine. But I guess it's just kind of two different philosophies there. What about you, Chris? Are you more of, you want to see the rookie quarterback start right away, or are you okay with, you know, giving him some reps and letting him watch and learn?
Man, it's one of those things where the prevailing thought on that issue has changed so many times over the years in the NFL. You know, it used to be customary for a rookie to sit, and then it wasn't. And, you know, now there's just so much money invested and, you know, so much draft capital given up for quarterbacks that, you know, there is a thought to rush into it. I fall more into the camp, I think, of getting the guy out there. It's hard to tell how much sitting and watching helps versus getting thrown right into the fire. There's so many different factors. Offensive line, do you have a good defense? Does your special team put you in horrible positions? I mean, there's a lot of things that can stunt your growth. But I also think there's, you know, there's unknowns to that where each guy is different. You know, some might have the mental makeup to be able to, you know, they might benefit more from the time on the sideline than they would, you know, just from being thrown in the fire. So, man, I just think that's a complete unknowable thing. So I generally just sort of take the boring route, which is, hey, the coaches are around these guys all the time. They sit with the quarterbacks. They best know the mental makeup of the quarterbacks. So, you know, whatever they decide for that specific player, I think generally is probably the right call. But if you're actually trying to win games and the person that is starting is Kevin Hogan, I'm going with Kizer.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah,
like real Venn diagram we just completed right there.
Yeah, and one more, you know, about this conversation. The other big thing is Kizer's number one problem. Really, I think a lot of it stems from just not getting rid of the ball quickly enough. And so you can make changes to your game plan and to help him get the ball out of his hands faster. Different pass patterns, different routes, screens, slants. Get the ball out of his hands. So that way you're making it more reactive than having to think through and progress through reads. And so I think there's some things that you could do to help with that. And the fact is, too, is that his receiving core, you know, is pretty trashy. You know, he hasn't had Corey Coleman. Terrell Pryor is gone. There's no receiving core there. I mean, do you know where any of those guys went to college that were playing this week? You know, it's that sort of thing.
I looked it up. I think Rashard Higgins went to Miami, but I would not bet even like an inch of my head on that. At all, that'd be right on that situation.
an inch of your head.
Yeah, not even an inch of my head.
Okay.
So if you felt safe about it,
you'd be willing to bet an inch of your head.
My skull hangs out of my head just a little bit, and I would give up a little of my scalp. I would not give up a little of my scalp to bet on that inch.
That avid outdoorsman in you makes you so tough. I'm jealous. See, sometimes the olds are the soft ones, and the millennial ones are the sharpened iron.
The Browns' passing offense is really bad this game again, and that interception that Hogan to Jonathan Joseph that was probably the easiest one I've ever seen. And if y'all remember correctly, Hogan overthrew his receiver by like probably 2 yards over his head, and it went right to Joseph, and there is absolutely nobody there. He stepping like 30 zone. The second interception was more impressive. You saw the cornerbacks do last year, like him and Bob, they played like 5 yards off from kind of soft zone and then just reacted and broke on the ball. And boy, it was last year. And Joseph had success doing it too. And it seemed like they're kind of going back to last year as far as like coverage schemes goes. Chris, how impressed were you with Joseph's second interception, the one where he stole the ball from the receiver, making the out route and read it perfectly?
Yeah, I mean, Joseph, he's been kind of weirdly inconsistent. He had some decent games last year. He had a couple of horrible games last year. It seems like he's been kind of up and down this year. But yeah, that one, I don't know if it's just one of those things where, since Hogan doesn't exactly have the arm strength of what you would call, an NFL quarterback, it told him that he could take more risks breaking on the ball. He probably, obviously a veteran like JJ does plenty of film study, so I'm sure he was well prepared for that. And the Browns aren't exactly good at making adjustments once they get themselves into a problem. So, yeah, JJ looked great. It's kind of I think a good portion of the fan base is probably surprised he hung around this year. He was a potential cut last offseason, especially with the idea that when push comes to shove, if they've got to choose JJ versus AJ Boye, they're obviously going to go with the younger, trending upward guy. But then that didn't happen. So. He's still healthy. He keeps chugging along. If we can get, 12 games out of him this year, I would have to be happy with that. But I've been pretty impressed with him in that game yesterday.
This is usually a time when BFD says something, but I really
I'm getting there. I wanted to make sure on something, so I was like scrambling for it, because I also got distracted by Lauren's personal
private browser.
Question. So
there's
that. Yeah, my. Hey, look, it's my private browser, not yours. So I think that I'm trying to remember. I should have looked at that. I think we officially – how many sacks did we have on Sunday? That's what one of the things I was trying to look at. Four, yeah. Which is not bad. I mean, their offensive line, Browns' offensive line isn't bad. But we were getting – I don't know. It just seems like we weren't getting great pressure on Hogan. So then when you turn around with the actual topic of the conversation being Jonathan Joseph here, is that Jonathan Joseph, I think at this point of his career, really needs to be he needs to help from the defensive line. He needs help from the defense to get pressure the quarterback into making poor throws. And I think that's what, he had the great pick, of course, but he's clearly lost his long speed, but the guy is still glue if he's within like 3 or 4 seconds of the snap. So he's an interesting guy to watch because cornerbacks just don't age gracefully, but he seems to be able to age gracefully. I'm thinking Daryl Green's the only one, Pac-Man Jones. There just aren't many of them that age gracefully when they get into their mid-30s. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's that Terrence Newman, red wine, unicorn blood thing with Joseph. And I think it's a good point you made. He's just really kind of interesting to watch just because it's so much like veteran savvy where he just recognizes routes really quickly. He's so good at that thing where his back is turned, the ball is in receiver's hands, and he just knocks out the last second to turn easy completions into incompletions. While his back is turned, he's chasing, and he's really good at that. And, I guess whenever he's running against faster guys and they're throwing deep passes, you can beat them and, take advantage of them. But, yeah, I think he's been really good this year in, like, more intermediate routes and shorter routes. where he can recognize the routes and, you know, break or allow his instincts and break sooner to, you know, stay in front of him and stay on those routes too. But I've been kind of impressed how I played. And the other guy is Kareem Jackson at the second cornerback slot. And I know if you look at the, you know, PFF numbers, or if you look at Football Outsiders adjusted success rate, you know, Jackson's had a bad year so far. Really the biggest joy I've gotten from watching him play is watching him tackle. He's been so good at that again this year. But, you know, all the numbers and stuff, he's one of the worst quarterbacks in the NFL. Chris, have you felt – what do you feel about Kareem Jackson so far this year? And did you think he had a good game on Sunday?
You know, it's hard to tell from the TV angles about a lot of specifics yesterday. I mean, I didn't see any blatantly horrible things that he did. But with Kareem, you know, as long as he's making tackles, because – you know, that's obviously his strength, like you said. We know the speed isn't there for coverage. We know that he's never gotten, you know, he's gotten better than he was in his first couple of years as far as locating the ball, but he's still not great at that. You know, he is who he is, but I think, again, when you have a situation where you've got arguably the worst starting quarterback in the league, Kevin Hogan, I mean, you're gonna notice, you're gonna combine your, you know, your years of you know, good film study with the idea that you've got this guy who doesn't have the good arm velocity, doesn't have good accuracy. And like I said, you can take a lot more chances. So, you know, I think, you know, he was fine yesterday. I just think it's one of those things where I want to give them credit, but I also just keep, it's one of those things where I'm watching this defense, just kind of waiting for the bottom to fall out on every series. Like I'm still shell-shocked, I think, from that last drive against New England. But obviously you're not playing Brady every week. But honestly, if you go back and watch that, I think as we talked about before, the Texans got some pretty bad breaks on that drive. But I just expect that they're going to keep focusing on Kareem as the season goes on, where we play better quarterbacks and obviously have better receivers, because, like you mentioned, their receiving corps is terrible and their quarterback situation is terrible as well. So it's just a really hard game to gauge anything on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think long-term that's an important point to make, especially when we start talking about the offense too, where, you know, Houston's played some really good games against some bad teams and, you know, have struggled in certain areas against, you know, better opponents. And I know BFD brought up the pass rush earlier and some about Joseph's play. And so if you didn't know, J.J. Watt's gone for the year, Winnie Merciless is gone for the year. But, you know, life keeps existing even after you're gone. And so the Texans went to work trying to replace these two players. And if you look at the snap counts, Cunningham played 87% of snaps. Brendan Scarlett, 75%, Clowney, 64%, Ufabu Kamalu, 54%, Covington, 57%, Dylan Cole, 13% before his injury, Dunn, 45%, Reader, 57%, Heath, 33%, and Carlos Watkins at 31%. BFD, did you think they were able to get a good pass rush at all this game? And with all these extra guys coming in there, is there anybody that you kind of saw stepped up at all in this one?
I guess on this one, I really wasn't all that impressed with the pass rush itself. I mean, we got some kind of junk sacks. I'm still not seeing what I want to see as far as imagination on our blitzes. And it didn't seem like I would like to see the stats, but it did not seem we were blitzing as much on Sunday, just, you know, simply because we didn't have to. You know, let's let Kevin Hogan chunk the ball downfield. We're all going to be good with that. So there wasn't really anything that stood out to me on the pass rush. I did want to say that Watkins stood out. I mean, it's no secret that I love me some DJ Reader at this point, but Watkins played a heck of a good game. So it's good seeing him develop. He's all, you know, one of his raps has been he doesn't have the I'm distracted by a thing. That he doesn't have like the motor. Don't ask Chris. You know, he doesn't have the motor and to go. But he looked really good on Sunday. So pass rush, not so much. I just don't know who we're going to find at this point in time. He's really going to generate much of a pass rush off the street, aside from Lamar Houston, who did collect the sack.
Yeah, BFD, while you take care of your 6,000 incognito browsers that are popping up all over you right now. I'll speak on this a little bit myself. So
popping
yeah,
up.
You know, I'll at least try to put a little bit of positive into this, because I think we all are pretty much in agreement that, hey, you know, you can't judge much against the Browns. But I will say this: they are set to have a pretty solid offensive line. BSE is absolutely right. Like the majority, I noticed the lack of pass rush way more than I ever noticed any pressure. I mean, there were several times where, you know, Hogan had all day to throw. Thank goodness he's Hogan, and thank goodness his receivers are his receivers. So yeah, there was just several times where I was just counting in my head how long he had to throw over and over and over again. But there were those sort of junk sacks like BFD said. But I will say this: my hope is, and again, I don't know because it was the Browns. My hope is the fact that they were able to get four sacks from four guys, none of them were named Clowney. That at least is a signal that instead of it just being against, you know, the Browns who have a good offensive line, I think maybe the positive spin on that could be maybe they are figuring a way to improve by scheme, since you know you're not gonna replace a Watt, you're not gonna replace a Merciless. You know, this team didn't really have reason to blitz too much when you have all those pass rushers, but now they're gonna have to start getting creative, like BFD said, and so far we haven't seen that. I'm hoping it's one of those situations kind of similar to Watson's development where, you know, his first start, he only had a short week, so he didn't really see this new offense until he actually had a full week. Well, now, with a bye week coming up, hopefully the defense, you know, Cornell gets in there, Vrabel, they put their heads together and see how they're going to scheme their way out of this this lack of pass rush that they're basically going to be stuck with the rest of the year, you know, on a player-by-player basis. But if those two guys, you know, Cornell obviously is a brilliant defensive mind. If they can manufacture pass rush with scheme, then, you know, hopefully they can at least just mitigate the loss of those guys.
Yeah, and last year, you know, pass rush wasn't that good either. It was mediocre. You know, Clowney and Merciless were really good. McKinney had a bunch of sacks, but it was just kind of those three guys and not a whole lot. And, like, you were talking about Cornell. He did a great job last year creating pressure in the interior by putting, you know, Merciless and Clowney over center. I mean, that New England game was spectacular, what he did. Using a lot of blitzes with Cushing and McKinney, the pass rusher running studs up the middle, pass rush. And they were able to do that. They also had, you know, a top, you know, six or five, however you want to spin it. And the secondary is able to hold up for a lot longer, too, as well. And so this year, without Watt or Merciless, like, it was a game where I didn't really see a whole lot of pass rush, like you were saying, Chris. And I'm not expecting really any of it all the entire year. And I'm not expecting the secondary to be very good the entire year, too. So, like, as good as this game was, I'm kind of leaning more in the end that, you know, this Texans defense is going to be bad without Watt and Merciless. There may be some games against bad offenses where they'll be okay, but I'm just really not optimistic at all in that regard. And, like, there was one snap where, you know, the defensive line was, like, Kamalu, Covington, Dunn, and, you know, Carlos Watkins, and you're like, this is a third quarter preseason, you know, week four defensive line right here. It's like, you know, you're about to play a really good offense like Pittsburgh pretty soon. You're going to have to play Tennessee again, things like that. And so it's just like, it's hard to take that, so that, like, those sorts of situations and extrapolate in the future and expect for it to be good. But I do think McKinney, Clowney, and, you know, Cunningham are more than, you know, above average, all three great players. So I think it's, even though the 20th best defense, not like the 25th best defense or the 15th, but it still should be, you know, more than capable enough with the really good offense behind them too.
Yeah, and look at all the guys who've come off the street already in the secondary as well. I mean, there's a real challenge in front of Romeo and Vrabel for the rest of the season to just, you know, keep teams from completely gashing them. You know, the idea used to be before, I mean, obviously, you know, we now have an offense, but you think pretty much there's a realistic chance that the Texans may not give up more than 14 points a game until recent events. So now you're just like, well, you know, you're looking at maybe 33-21 kind of games where you just hope the defense can scheme its way out. I just, you know, you got Marcus Williams, I think they signed last week, and he was in there playing a decent amount. I saw him several times on Sunday, if I'm not mistaken. Starting the year out with Gilchrist, you know, there's other names that have already come and gone, that Tristan Dekou guy's getting a lot of playing time. I mean, there's just a lot of things in the secondary where, you know, it's almost like they lost someone important in their secondary that they should have franchise tagged, but I guess we've probably been over that a million times. And then on top of that, yeah, of course, you lose Kevin Johnson. So there's just been sort of a revolving door on the back end as well. And I just have this feeling of dread, like it's all just sort of held together with duct tape, and that the norm is eventually going to be them getting gashed when they play real offenses. But that's where I put my hope and faith in Romeo Crennel and Vrabel.
Yeah, I kind of forgot Kevin Johnson's coming back. And, you know, my last words on this planet are going to be, Texans should franchise tag. I'm going to be so happy whenever I enter the next life. You know, BFD, you mentioned that question from Lawrence Person, and it was, are our defensive players decent, or is this just a factory status effect? And I guess he's getting at the new defensive players, so everybody's kind of come off the bench and have kind of come out of nowhere and have to, you know, fill in the holes with Juan Merciless out. Do you think any of these guys are any good? And is there anyone that you think should get more playing time than they should have on Sunday as well?
I think we're going to see – we should see a lot more snaps from Lamar Houston, I would hope, because he's really been the guy that we've got that's new, that has a history of creating havoc on the quarterback. Everybody else, I mean, it'd be great if Brandon Scarlett could step up in that role. I just don't see it happening. I really do think this is the factory of sadness effect. It's Kevin Hogan is just terrible. That offensive line is decent, but – there are so many holes on that team. You know, it's like I make the joke. I'm pretty sure back to my intramural days, our IM quarterback could be better than Kevin Hogan. I know he threw with more of a velocity than Kevin Hogan did. That's for damn sure.
What about you?
Yeah,
Chris?
And
is
I guess before we move on, I just you know, yeah, I think we kind of hit on the fact that it is a little bit of a result of the scheme right now. I don't know about these individual guys coming in and out. I just have to sort of take the boring tack here. I got to agree with BFD. You know, Lamar Houston, if he has anything left, he's definitely a guy who could contribute and be, you know, probably have a ceiling of better than average at this point in his career. Even if we only get a few weeks out of it and he's a little older, I know he's had two. I think he's ripped the ACL and for two straight years on either side. So, whatever you get out of him is a bonus, already with a strip sack fumble on Sunday, which is great. You know, I don't know if we're going to hit on Dylan Cole a little bit more here, Matt, but,
yeah, go ahead.
How crazy was it to see a linebacker running stride for stride along the sideline, with a opposing team's running back, and then him actually look up and locate the ball? I mean, that was a hell of a play. And you look at that play, and then you look at the play against the Titans where he knocked the – I don't remember if it was the tight end or their fullback or someone. He knocked someone off their route and then jumped in front of Delanie Walker and ran it back for that pick six. I mean, that was an incredible play. And now you have his second incredible play of the season. I think the latest news is he's going to miss at least 4 weeks, which I guess when you see a guy carted off, you have to consider that a bullet dodge. But with a hamstring, you never know. When they say at least 4 weeks, I've heard the general rule of thumb – with a hamstring is once it feels 100%, wait two more weeks.
Mm.
Yeah, the soft tissue injuries are a real bear. They're just no fun.
Yeah, so, you know, that line, the young linebacker play, I mean, Cunningham and Cole have, I think, had to – obviously Cole has exceeded everybody's expectations, and Cunningham's obviously getting more playing time than we ever thought he would due to the pushing issue and just the fact that he's played fairly well a good portion of the season. So they've acquitted themselves pretty well. Let's just hope that let's at least hope that our unexpected effective inside linebackers can actually stay healthy. We'd have one position group on the defense that could stay healthy. That would be nice.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Brian Cushing will say this. I know it.
Oh. Yeah. Well, yeah. It's already gone because Cole hurt himself. So I guess it can't put that one on me 100%.
Yeah, and also with Cole playing too, you can also put him outside linebacker a little bit as well because of his speed, or put Cunningham outside linebacker too because of speed, and he just gives you a lot of versatility. And I'm upset Cole's hurt because MDC couldn't get his J14 magazine cover with Dylan Cole there before that happened. So hopefully he comes back and plays well enough for a new issue to come out for him so he can get that cover to hang in his office. But the last thing defensively I want to touch on is that the Browns did run the ball well in this game. They ran the ball 22 times for 134 yards, averaged 6.1 yards a carry. Duke Johnson averaged 8 yards a carry. Isaiah Crowell averaged 4.8. And, you know, the Browns are a pretty good run team. They ranked 15th in DVOA on the ground entering this game. And, you know, the Texans were one of the better run-stopping teams in the league. And that was before they lost, you know, Merciless and Watt, of course. Chris, are you worried at all about the run defense going forward? I know the pass defense, you know, had a great game, but the run defense kind of suffered. And are you worried about this kind of being an issue at all?
Yeah, I mean, I'm just worried about the defense as a whole going forward for the, you know, things we've already discussed. But yeah, you know, Duke Johnson is a pretty talented running back behind a pretty talented offensive line. Just there's no threat of a passing game, so you don't really know what, you know, you have no idea what he really could be if he was on a decent team. But yeah, you know, they were getting gashed pretty well there. I feel like I'm a little bit more confident in the run defense going forward than I am the pass defense, which is unusual, I guess, since there's been more injuries on the front seven than there has been on the back end. But I'm just not trusting that safety and cornerback situation 100% right now. So yeah, it concerns me. But I feel like, you know, Cornell he's at least done well enough with Watt last year to limit the run game just being a total disaster all season against us. And I feel like he can do the same again this year, even if he has lost a couple of cogs. I'm more concerned about the pass defense than I am running defense, if that's an acceptable answer.
Yeah, I think that's a more than acceptable answer. Just, you know, piggybacking on that a little bit. I'm done.
Yeah, that was a great answer. I was going to say, that's better than what a BFD can give us so we can move forward before he started to open his mouth. Let's move over to the offense. Deshaun Watson was great again against a bad passing defense, and the run game was whatever in this one. The Houston Oilers were before my time. I've said this story before, but I watched them during training camp at Trinity University when I was like 6 years old, and we were out there for like 30 minutes, and it rained a little bit, and they all went inside. I was like, man, I hate the Oilers after that happened, but that's my only real memory of them whatsoever. And so, but entering this game, Deshaun Watson actually wore Warren Moody's jersey before the game started. So, PFT, is Warren Moody good? I don't know who he is. Is he a good player? Should I watch some YouTube videos of him?
Warren Moon is, yes, he was a good player, but he was also, even when he was active, he created a lot of bipolar sentiment, just because a lot of people would blame him for the offensive ills, even though he put up big numbers. Of course, that was also partly because of the system with the run and shoot offense. You know, he's a Hall of Famer. There's a lot of good about Warren Moon, but a lot of people also put the problems with the playoffs directly on his shoulders. He also had a tendency to get hurt at clutch times and allow Commander Cody Carlson to come in and try to play football, which was just ugly.
He went to Churchill High
School. Oh, Commander Cody?
Yeah, that's where I went to high school at. They had a frame photo of him on the walls there.
That's awesome. I knew he went here. Yeah, because he went to Baylor, you know. He just replayed his college ball. No, but Warren Moon was, yes, he was a very good football player. I think he somewhat gets a bum rap, but I can hear Chris like grunting and groaning. So either he's got his incognito window up, or he has something to say about Warren Moon.
No, I was just waiting for Warren Moon slander there to fly out of Weston, but he managed to. He doesn't want to upset the olds. He knows that we are on blood thinners, and he doesn't want us to get upset. So, yeah, Warren Moon, I mean, you know, I know this is not the Warren Moon show, but he is obviously one of my favorite players. We had season tickets for two seasons during the run and shoot era. As I've probably said way too many times, I actually went to the Buffalo game, the infamous Buffalo game. I was there, saw it in person. So I have a lot of positive and negative memories tied to the Oilers and Warren Moon. And yeah, I mean – you know, he's one of those guys who was never the best in the league during his career, but definitely the gaudy numbers. You know, he was crazy accurate, had a crazy strong arm, you know, pretty much had a spotless existence off the field until some bad things happened towards the end. BFD, I'm sure you remember.
I remember.
Yeah, not a good look. Had some domestic violence issues. But yeah, you know, I don't know, looking at his career, if he was a first ballot Hall of Famer, but because of what he did off the field, the fact that he was, you know, one of the first hugely successful, well, I think probably the first hugely successful black quarterback other than, I'm getting my Doug Williams timeline mixed up, but, you know, he had, at the time when he was signed from Canada, he had the highest salary in the NFL. He went through a lot of bad stuff in Houston because there's just a lot of racist pieces of crap, frankly. So he had to go through that, and there's so many, you know, young black quarterbacks over the years, I'm sure, that looked up to him and that were that inspired them to say, you know, I don't want to play receiver, I don't want to play this, I want to stick to playing quarterback. And I think that's kind of an immeasurable impact of Warren Moon.
Yeah, and just to be clear here, what the story was back then is that black quarterbacks weren't smart enough to play
quarterback. Yeah. We shouldn't try to sort of whitewash what the actual issue was. That was literally the issue, Matt, is that it was just sort of this unspoken thing. I'm sure much spoken behind closed doors.
It was very out loud.
Well, with fans, for sure. It was just an ugly time, and it's one of those things where it worked out. You know, we have to give Bud Adams some retroactive credit for bringing him in and signing him for the big deal he did and all that. And it was a great thing, you know, off the field as well as on. I just think, you know, that's the one thing that I'll give Bud Adams credit for in the history of his existence, was recognizing that and you know, being sort of a helping Moon to become a pioneer, basically.
Okay, cool. I'll actually go online and watch some videos of that. What were you saying, BFT?
One other thing to look at is he wasn't even in the NFL until he was 28. Mm-hmm. You know, so when you look at what he did, you know, he retired when he was 44. He hung around a long time. He was productive for a long time. You know, even on the longevity things, that he didn't start in the NFL until he was 28 is just pretty amazing.
Yeah, and it's called the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And if I'm not mistaken, he's still the all-time leader in professional football passing yards, probably by a good
margin. Passing yards.
Is he in the Hall of Fame?
Say again?
Mm-hmm.
Is he in the Hall of Fame?
Oh, yeah.
Not really. I went to the Hall of Fame. I guess I didn't notice his name there. There's just so many busts in there. It's hard to see them all, you know?
Yeah. Sure.
Were you at a strip joint, or were you at the Hall of Fame?
They got one in Canon, and they're both very fun, whatever it is.
Weston probably saw a rock climbing wall. He saw a rock climbing wall and got distracted and just completely missed it.
Right.
No, I don't do that. I walk and I look at the flowers really closely. I don't do rock climbing at all. Maybe one day. I'm not strong enough for that. All right, so I think you convinced me. And it's kind of funny. Blog Talk has like a stats ratio of like the, you know, breaking down our demographics of who listens to the show. And it's all just like men from the ages of like 28 to 44 is just our huge demographic. So I assume that the majority of them, you know, plenty about Warren Moon. But if anybody's younger, I'm going to watch tonight. We'll get some Warren Moon videos and check them out. Because I've never watched any highlights of them. I've heard a little bit about Run Shoot, but I don't know what it means. I watched a bunch of Bump Phillip videos when we spoke for the first time, like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago that was. Whenever he passed away. So I enjoy learning about him, and I'll do some research and write a report on Warren Moon for, you know, both of you by the end of the week. Now, as good as Warren Moon seems to have been, Deshaun Watson is better. He's the greatest quarterback of all time. There is nobody better than, you know, him ever to play the game of football. And I still can't get over it. I don't know what to do with myself. These aren't my Houston Texans. It's just so strange. I know in the preseason I asked Luke, would you consider the season a success if the Texans missed the playoffs, but Watson threw for like 30 touchdowns and like 12 interceptions? And he said, 100% yes. I said 100% yes. And he's been even better than that somehow. Now, the only concern I have at all is that, you know, this offense struggled against Cincinnati. I know it was a short week. They only played, you know, they had to play on Thursday night. It's hard putting offense together that quickly. And they also struggled against Kansas City Chiefs. And both these are actually, you know, pretty good. You know, Kansas City has a great defense. Cincinnati's is probably good. I know it's been kind of lackluster the first 2 weeks of the year. But against bad, you know, Cleveland's 31st in way. I believe Tennessee's 30th. You know, Jacoby Brissett and the Colts just put, you know, 20-something points on them. New England is 32nd in pass defense DVOA. And so Houston's had a lot of success in the passing game, but it's been against bad defenses. And so, Chris, are you all in on Watson, this offense, or do you have any concerns at all because of the schedules and the teams that they play? Or are you kind of just like, you know, this has been awesome so far, but I need to watch them, you know, play Seattle and, you know, teams like that first before I go all in?
100% all in. So all in. There's other things that I will hedge about the Texans, which, like I said, you know, the defense, it was into the Browns. This portion of the game, this, you know, the passing game specifically or the running game specifically didn't look good because of this team they were playing. But when it comes to Watson himself, oh yeah, I'm 100% in. And the thing is, I think as the weeks have gone by, we've seen him continue to do the things that the other rookies that are talked about who had success early and then fell off a cliff weren't able to do. you know, in the first time that I noticed him, you know, looking off the safety against the Patriots, you know, when he made that pass, I immediately ran the DVR back and I was like, did he just do that? And then he kept doing it. He's freezing linebackers. He's looking off safeties. He's doing those things that, you know, a BY never did when he had rookie success. Those things that I think RG3 did for like 3 weeks in his rookie year and then lost the ability and then got himself killed. Plus, you know, Deshaun's work ethic has already sort of become in legendary status. You can see that he's obviously a leader. The guys gravitate to him. This is one of those things that is probably not a big deal, but I noticed it pretty quickly, which I think was week 3 or 4 in one of the videos from a post win. He was breaking down the huddle in the locker room, and that's, you know, that's just something that leaders do, that established guys do. So yeah, I'm all in with Watson. I mean, he's gonna have bumps. That pick six had been coming all season. Although the way he threw that pick six wasn't the type of pick six I thought it was gonna be. There were so many others earlier in the year, frankly, that were easier ones than that one was, that had been dropped. But he got that. Hopefully, he got that out of the system a little bit. I know he was upset about it. But yeah, obviously there's going to be bumps. There's going to be mistakes. We just all have to hope that O'Brien won't get him killed. There was that one really strange running play where we were already up, where they had a design run where Watson, I think, ended up taking it between the guard and tackle. Like, what are you doing? And this is clearly a design play. You have running backs for that, especially when you're nursing a lead. So, you know, if O'Brien doesn't get him killed, I see nothing but good. You see him dropping it in the perfect spot on that Will Fuller pass, hit him in stride, put it on his outside shoulder. I mean, he's doing things that just, you know, it's impossible not to be super excited about this guy. And I just don't understand how anyone couldn't be 100% on board with this guy right now.
This is how good Deshaun Watson is. Deshaun Watson is so good, he could teach a fourth-year head coach in the NFL how to run an offense. That's what Deshaun Watson is.
Not even a joke.
He's so good, your mama said – oh, wait, I'm going to butcher that. This offense is Deshaun Watson's offense. This is not Bill O'Brien's offense. And that's because Bill O'Brien and Deshaun Watson sat down – and I'm guessing the conversation with something along the lines of, hey, Bill, your offensive scheme sucks. I've been sitting here on the sideline watching it. I've been watching Tom Savage robot his way through it. It's trash. How about we do these things? So even if we don't give the credit to Deshaun Watson, we got to at least give it to Dave O'Swinney, right?
and I just would – I would just add to that, you know, Watson, there's this – so this style of offense of playing, like this college hybrid offense, all this stuff that Deshaun – like we talked – like, I mean, O'Brien admitted himself that he sat down with Deshaun and Deshaun walked him through how to translate what he did at Clemson into the NFL. I mean, it's not a mystery. So Watson's always obviously had a lot of input himself into this. And I just – there's a – the guy – when you have these new kind of – offenses that pop up and they turn around so quickly. Everyone always says the league adjusts. And it will. The league will adjust to a certain point. The difference is he can also look off the safeties with his eyes. He also is recognizing coverages. He's also dropping the ball where it's supposed to be. It's not just the success of the system. It's the danger that he creates when he can actually sit back there in the shotgun and also pick apart a defense. I mean, having that level of quarterback play is just something that I'm not going to get used to all season, and I'm just going to keep on enjoying it every week. I basically every time I throw the touchdown pass, I just shake my head in disbelief.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the league adjusting. I think this offense usually works for 1 year, and then maybe the next year, you know, the NFL adjusts some to what they're doing. But I think the one about Watson, I think, really reminds me of the Russell Wilson thing that happened whenever Wilson became a rookie, where you had a guy who's a veteran, Matt Flynn, who was supposed to be the starter all summer. And then you start hearing these whisperings throughout training camp, like, oh, wow, you know, Wilson's such a natural leader. You know, he's taking command of the huddle. Everybody here loves him. You know, this kid's going to be special. And you see all that stuff. And then what happened week one is that Russell Wilson's starting quarterback. The Texans, you saw the same thing sort of happened with Watson. And then it all kind of got squashed before that first preseason game when Bill O'Brien was you know, unequivocally Tom Savage their starter, which was, you know, incredibly stupid to do at the time. It was incredibly stupid after the first play of week one. It was incredibly stupid, you know, every moment of the way, and he learned and changed really quickly. But it's the same similar sort of player. So I'm 100% in on Deshaun Watson as a franchise quarterback. I'm just not 100% in on this offense being good enough to lead a bad defense every game until I see him, you know, play really well against a great defense. And I know this Seattle game's 13 days away, but I'm so, you know, I'm oozing out all my, I'm sitting down. There's a wet right now because I'm so excited for the Seattle game to watch, you know, watch defense and to look off Earl Thomas because he's so good looking off Earl Thomas is going to be something else. That's just how I am. I think a lot of it too is just having, you know, you're heartbroken so many times watching a stupid football team that even when something's as good as Watson is, it's hard to, you know, go all in until you see that, you know, last result. So, but yeah, it's just been incredible watching this year.
Yeah, but you say that about, you know, the college pro style hybrid. You know, that's exactly what the Chiefs are doing out there. That's what they're running, is that offense. And so it can, I think, be successful in the long term. And they've been running a flavor of it for a couple of years now. You can be successful with this kind of offense in the long term, I do believe, in today's NFL.
Yeah, I think you just have to keep adding layers to it because this is like the pinnacle of like 4 years of game plan for Andy Reid. Like, I know I read about like the screen passes he ran and like all this time he's done such a good job of like turning Alex Smith into a point guard and now it's like evolved into this just crazy thing. And then it felt so weird on Sundays too with all these little shovel passes, all these options. Like the Jets ran that little shovel pass for a goal line play with, you know, McCown and Matt Forte. I couldn't believe that. And then the jet sweep, too, like how often jet sweep's been used has been, you know, really remarkable, too. So I think it, like, you have to keep building on it. You can't really stay stagnant and say this is our offense that we're going to do. You have to keep adding personnel layers to it.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
All right, well, the only other stuff I had here was, you know, Dwayne Brown and Chris Clark and Will Fuller. And, you know, we've talked enough about that. And we've already, you know, been on for long enough. So, BFD, we're going to squash some beef. We're going to talk about Blade Runner
for a little bit. Hold on. Can I raise my hand real quick?
Yeah.
Hey, Matt, did you see the clip I sent out of the punt gunner from Sunday?
Yeah, I saw that. And nothing surprised me about this team because they use on special teams because they used Jay Proch as a gunner once. Against Minnesota. Uh-huh. So whatever they do, none of it surprises me at all. It's just really bad.
It was just so comically hilarious that the guy was escorted out of there like he was about to carry down an assassination. If you watch the replay, those two Cleveland Browns run him to the other side of the field, and as the clip ends, they're running him diagonally out of the back of the end zone, presumably towards the tunnel, to throw him out of the stadium. I think that was Chris Thompson. I'm not entirely sure, but I think that was Chris Thompson. And he got speed escorted out of the building. It's just embarrassing.
Not even streakers get kicked out of games that quickly.
That's true.
I mean, you at least get to see the dong for longer, you know?
Yeah, anyone listening who hasn't seen that, I tweeted out earlier at Houston Diehards if you want to check it out. It's focus your eyes on sort of the bottom portion of the screen where the near side gunner, which again I think is Chris Thompson, just gets run out of the building. And if you put like a Benny Hill or a Yakety Sax soundtrack under it, it would be appropriate. By the way, Benny Hill reference is even too old for me, so I don't know why I just dropped that. That predates me as well. So,
you're an American, you know. Do you have anything to add, BFD, before you're blown off with your ashes into the dust?
Yeah, you kids today suck. That's all I'm going to end with. You all right. So we're all going to go out. So just so everybody's aware, the entire BRB staff is going to go get DW4 tattoos. And so we hope you join us for that.
Yeah. Sounds like a fundraiser.
As long as tattoo, I'm okay with it.
All right.
The bigger
Thanks,
the donation,
guys.
The bigger the tattoo.
On
BFD, of course. On BFD.
All right. Thanks, y'all. Have fun. I'm going to go to sleep now.
All right. So if you're still listening and you haven't seen Blade Runner, turn this off if you don't care at all. turn this off. If you just like the Summer Voices or have seen Blade Runner, keep listening. So first off, Chris, make the case for Blade Runner 1 for me. Sell me on it.
Oh, geez. Okay. So again, all cards on the table. I was a film major. I feel like every person in the world should at least be a snob about one thing. And for me, it's movies, or as people like me call it, film. And the thing about Blade Runner is if you're a big science fiction fan, you probably love it. If you are more of an adventure science fiction fan where you like your science fiction to be about explosions and aliens and, you know, spaceships exploding and running into each other and, you know, planets being turned into dust and all that stuff, then it may not be your bag. But if you like hard science fiction, I might even stretch it to say more reality-based science fiction, dystopian sci-fi, then you already love Blade Runner. I can't really talk you out of that if you're not a fan of dystopian science fiction. So what I will focus on is the important thing to remember really about any movie when it's not a current movie is you have to watch it in the proper context. That doesn't make the movie better or worse. That's granted. But at least watch it with the proper context. And with Blade Runner, Ridley Scott was doing some things that people hadn't seen before. If you watch the movie and you watch how the shots are set up, if you watch how the lighting is done, little dramatic, shadowy lighting, using smoke for lighting, using rippling water for lighting. He also was the guy who sort of started that trend of having the inexplicable giant slowly turning fan in the background of shots. Like, that was Blade Runner. Basically, it's film noir. It's a 1940s crime drama set in 2019 Los Angeles. And it just inspired so much. And that's not always a good thing. I'll use Pulp Fiction as an example. Pulp Fiction, love that movie, one of my favorites. But it also spawned this sort of copycat genre where for every one movie that was sort of a rip on Pulp Fiction that was good, there were 10 terrible ones. So there's a lot of people copying that style. There's a lot of people that incorporated that style that you see in all these directors. And, you know, it's a compliment. I forget what that phrase is. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. That applies to Blade Runner when you watch not just science fiction movies that came after it, but just movies in general. There's just so much that inspired so many different filmmakers, so many things that sort of paved the way. It also has a historically great villain, Roy Batty, played by Rutger Hauer, just has a tremendous performance in that movie, has a great historic monologue at the end of the movie that he allegedly improvised. So that's it. Also, I thought it had a pretty good ending. Harrison Ford, back when he actually used to try to act. Ridley Scott is an unquestionably great director, even if he hasn't been great in the last, 15 years. So that would be my case.
Yeah, that's a good case. I mean, my thing with this, I've watched this movie 3 times. I always fall asleep in the same part. There's like that hour lull, pretty much, where the chick with the black hair shoots a bad guy from the beginning in the back of the head. And there's just like an hour and a whole lot happens, it feels like. And I always fall asleep there. But like just at the beginning, and I guess just like watching it, like that's the biggest thing I've taken away. It's kind of like what you were saying, was that if I was alive in 1982, I would have pooped my pants watching that movie, because it looks like it could still be recently released today. Like, it's shot, the models are great. It's not a pretty movie because it's so gross, wet, dark. It's rained the whole time. All that puppet stuff in that house is just, and it's kind of like watch and everything's like dark and rainy, but it's hard to watch in some parts just because of how, I guess they kind of get, it's just so banal seeing all the same colors and that, just the wet and the rain and all that. But
yeah,
I think that's
monochromatic.
The best way
it's dark. It's dystopian. It's, those are all hallmarks of that genre, but that doesn't make it good or bad. So
yeah.
I for sure. Those are definitely hallmarks of the genre. Of course, they wanted to create that future Los Angeles that it's raining, it never rains in Los Angeles. There's just so many things. It's another thing. They don't really fill you in on things that have happened to create this environment. They just kind of, and I love movies that do that. Like, the world is in some strange state of affairs, whether it be weather-wise or politically, and they never really explain it. It's just part of the setting.
Yeah, it's just good, right? Like the snake in that scene, is this real? I think also like all the billboards and stuff, how big they are and how they're holograms. two really good examples of that. And it kind of reminded me, like, I read Dune this summer, and I didn't think Dune's a very good book. Like, I like to watch science fiction more than read it. But reading Dune, and I saw when it came out, I was like, oh, yeah, it makes perfect sense why this is such a big thing and such a, you know, cornerstone of, I guess, like, you know, science fiction, those sorts of books. Because it, I mean, it, like, it's pretty much the same thing as Game of Thrones is now, but just in a desert with aliens and less sex and less people dying. And, you know, I love the desert, and so all that sort of stuff was cool, too. But it's kind of the same thing where, like, it needs, like, the context of where it was coming from, I think, to, like, fully appreciate it. But really my only gripe with Blame Runner is just that I have 45 minutes where I just fall asleep every time. And if it was, I guess, a little bit faster paced in that way or had more going on there, I would enjoy that movie a lot more.
Yeah, that's fair. And also, just like a lot of directors do today, you know, when they map out their plan for the future setting, they want to try to take swings at what the technology is going to be like. You got to take some big swings. You got to assume that some things aren't going to evolve very much. So, you know, there is definitely some misses in there. Obviously there's no flying cars. The umbrellas with the lit up stems, I don't know if you remember from your last viewing, there's some strange stuff in there. And of course the biggest swing and miss, technologically the biggest swing and miss from that movie is that, you know, all the computer screens were still the giant, you know, Apple IIb style.
Yeah.
That were appropriate at the time. That's the biggest technological miss from that movie. So there's some funny things in there where you watch it now and you just, like, have to laugh to yourself about how completely wrong the team was that were taking some big guesses there.
Yeah, I'm only 2 years away from that too as well. And I think that's what all science fiction is, though, is that you take an event or take, like, a problem going on with society today, extrapolate that, you know, 30 years later, 40 years later, and then kind of tell a story about what's going on now, but just, you know, much later on too. So I watched the second, you're saying?
I was just going to say another movie that I love how they handled that, the future setting, and didn't really go into detail about how it got there, but watching it just even now, a few years later, it's crazy how much the real world is trending towards it. I don't know if you've seen it. It's a movie called Children of Men with Clive Owen. I won't give anything away. It's probably my favorite. Honestly, it's probably my favorite movie, possibly my favorite movie of any genre in this century. It came out in, I want to say 2010 or 2011. And another dystopian based on sort of, you know, futuristic but realistic future science fiction. And I won't give anything away, but I'll just put it this way. There's a very big focus on how much the world has changed because of the changing attitudes towards immigration that permeates that entire movie. And when you watch it now, you're just like, wow, this seems like we're only a step away from this.
Huh. Yeah. I watched that movie and I was like 15 and I played sick from school to watch movies all day. I watched that one and I really didn't get it. I was too young to watch it, but based off your recommendation, I'll go back and turn around and watch that. But I know the plots. There's, you know, nobody can be pregnant. This woman's pregnant. They're trying to, you know, save her and
right.
go through all that.
Correct. Yeah. I think it's just a really tight script. The world that the filmmaker creates is fantastic. There's some, if you watch it from a filmmaker point of view, there's a lot of just super technically incredible shots that, you know, are the long shots with no interruption where they've obviously had to choreograph that out from, you know, start to finish every step. And, you know, you just start noticing, oh my God, they haven't cut. This is not a special effect. They haven't cut in, you know, like a minute and a half. It's this crazy long shot with all these incredible things happening that just have to be, you know, timed perfectly other than the effects they put on top of it. But
yeah.
Just the timing of that, I just really appreciate filmmakers who take risks. And the guy who directed that one is one of those guys, Alfonso Cuarón, one of my favorites.
What else has he directed?
Let's see. He did his first big movie was Y Tu Mama Tambien. I don't know if you ever saw that one.
No, I never saw that. I remember it coming whenever it came out. I was like, that's a dumb name for a movie. But I think I was like 13 or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. That was one of his big ones. I think he also did City of God.
Yeah, I like City of God a lot.
Yeah, that one's one of my favorites. He also directed the only Harry Potter movie that I can actually stand to watch, which is because of his direction, which is...
Oh, that's me, man.
Azkaban, that's it. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm struggling to remember what his most recent release was, but
did he do the space movie where with Sandra Bullock and George Clooney?
Ah, yes, good man, Gravity. Yes, he did.
Yeah, I never saw Gravity because I'm afraid of falling after skydiving. I was like, yeah, I can't watch two people fall in our space for, you know, an hour and a half minutes, be able to sit still and not have, you know, complete vertigo afterwards.
It's one of those movies where, kind of similar to how I feel about one of your favorites, Boyhood, I respect the, like, I love Alfonso Cuarón. I don't love Gravity, like, for the achievement of it, the technical achievement of it, it's worth seeing. That's the kind of the same way I feel about Boyhood, which is a totally different genre, but I like the achievement of it. I like the thing that they did that was different, and the same with Gravity. I liked the risk that he took, but the actual movie in and of itself, you know, and kind of like Avatar. Like, Avatar, I don't think is a great movie at all, but I respect the overwhelmingly huge technical achievement of it. But like I said, that doesn't make it a good movie. I realize that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess to go to Blade Runner, I saw it last Friday, and it was weird. And I guess, like, you know, going back to Boyhood too, like, I didn't really like the plot of Boyhood, but I guess, like, whenever I watch movies, because it's such a, it's personal in a way where, like, you're, again, just like the visualization closely tied to memory. And so whenever I watch a movie, like, I'm usually just, I really don't care about the plot all that much. I just, three or, you know, a few things just really grab me. Like, so for example, Texas, like 2 weeks ago, and just like the opening shot, like this man wandering West Texas by himself. I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is made, you know, just for me. And so that's how I kind of am with movies. And so Blade Runner, the second one, and the same thing kind of similar happened to me in that one too, where there was just like three or four themes that just like, you know, really got me. And, you know, I really just loved. And so I know the plot, you know, kind of drags on at times. There's some meandering here and there. I know I've saw some complaints that it wants to be deep, but it's actually really shallow. I don't really think that's true at all. But there were just four things that I really loved in that movie. So what were your kind of initial thoughts on the second Blade Runner?
I let me just correct one thing. City of God was not Alfonso Cuarón. That was Fernando Mieralas, who also did The Constant Gardener. So different guy. I got my awesome Latin directors mixed up. Okay. Anyway, but yes, I highly recommend City of God as well. Blade Runner. I liked it a lot. I don't think I loved it. I liked it a lot. A director is crazy talented. You know, he did Arrival. I assume he brought back his same cinematographer that he had in Arrival, who was the champion of that movie, I thought. And yeah, Blade Runner, I mean, gorgeous setting. Again, similar to Blade Runner, the original, where they established this world. You really have no idea why it's that way. That first sequence where Kay lowers himself down in that community where the guy played by Dave Bautista is hiding out or whatever in that little warehouse, and they have the plastic coverings. Obviously, you know, there's global warming effects going on there, so there's all these things that have happened. You know, I think we've already warned everyone about spoilers, so we will speak without worrying about it, but one last time, spoilers if you haven't seen it. At the end, you know, they have the giant wall where they have the final fight. Obviously that's got to also be a call to global warming and them, you know, setting up these giant walls to stem the flow of water coming into the country. Mm-hmm. I assume just all this unspoken stuff. I love the storyline of how, just like in the original, you know, the replicants, you know, unless they know the truth, they think they're real. You know, they at least have the capacity to think they're real. So Ryan Gosling's character is struggling with that the entire time. There's that brief moment of the movie where he thinks maybe he's, you know, the son and an actual real person, and he struggles with that. And you have the, you know, the projected girlfriend. That was the thing that got a little bit tiresome to me, was they kept going back to this relationship he had with his, you know, not real girlfriend. Now I understand thematically what they were doing there, but I just thought in a movie that was 2 hours and 45 minutes, they could have cut one of those 5 minute scenes to get the running time down a little bit leaner.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that it suffered from, it didn't have a coherent villain. The main villain really turned out to be, I think her name was Luv, L-U-V, the kick-ass, the ass-kicking replicant chick. She was more of a henchman than a villain. And the Jared Leto character, listen, Jared Leto can ruin anything. I cannot stand him. But I think, I don't know if the director kind of saw that and just didn't have him in the final cut very much. He was barely in it. So he was more of a mastermind, not a villain. And the Love the Robot was more of a henchman and not a villain. And it's hard to not compare that to Blade Runner, which to me has one of the all-time great science fiction or otherwise villains in Roy Batty, played by Rutger Hauer. So I think that suffered a little bit too. There's a lot of things that happen in Ryan Gosling's head in that movie. And I think he's a good enough actor. Like he's kind of starting to become that actor where he plays Ryan Gosling now. Where he just sort of looks cool and off into the distance the whole time. And I guess one last thing I will say, Harrison Ford, I don't think has tried in a movie. I can't even remember the last time. Terrible in the Indiana Jones remake, which is the thing that makes me the most upset in the history of movies is Indiana Jones 4. Like I get stabby. Terrible on that, mailed it in. Obviously the Star Wars movies mailed it in. I actually thought he was trying to act in this movie. So that was kind of refreshing. You know, he actually had to show some emotion in this movie. I didn't feel like he was cashing a check as much as I have in his more recent work. So that was good. And I also think that's what happens when actors are paired with good directors. Directors get more out of actors. And yeah. I really think a lot of people don't understand what working with a talented director does for an actor. There's some actors who, I'll just give you a real quick example. Don Cheadle, pretty popular actor. People think he's a genius. If you watch his movies where he works with a talented director, he's great. If you watch his movies where he's working with sort of a middling or a not so good director, he is terrible. So I really think, you know, he's just, I think the director, Denis Villeneuve, got a lot out of Harrison Ford, a lot more than I think I would have anticipated.
Yeah, I see what you're saying there when it comes to Harrison Ford. I thought he just kind of plays like himself. He's also almost died like 3 times flying the airplane. So I think it's hard for him to really fake any emotion after he's done times. And he's, I didn't think about that at all, that fight scene where they have that bridge there, I guess, keeping the water up to prevent the floods. I didn't think about it like that, but that's true. But a lot of the global warming stuff I thought was really interesting. And I guess it goes back to, like I said earlier, about, you know, science fiction, where you take something now and you extrapolate it, you know, X amount of years in the future, and you kind of think about what it's going to be like. And just like seeing the cities the way they are, just seeing like, you know, the desert completely unlivable, just kind of really broke my heart, because I guess, you know, you just kind of think about moving forward. Like, that's the last way I want to live is, you know, where it's pretty much like pictures of China right now look exactly like Blade Runner. And so you take that and you add 30 years to it. And it's just, you know, horrifying thing about, you know, being stuck to living a life like that because of the decisions we're making now. And so all that really, really made me feel gross and terrible. Made me want to hop in my car and drive out to the desert immediately afterwards. Also, the other thing about, I love that scene so much when they were fighting with the Elvis hologram playing, because that was just spectacular. And I think that's one thing for sure that we saw in the movie that's going to happen in the future, is that there's going to be hologram entertainment like that. We already kind of saw at Coachella with them bringing Tupac on stage. So I think that's one thing that's going to happen for sure. And just that entire scene was just, you know, spectacular there. I know you mentioned the, you know, him and like the memories he implanted him, how he wanted to be real. I think that's also just human nature too, where we're all born and we want to be special. We all think that, you know, we're innate. We have this certain thing that we could do. If we just find it, we'll be, you know, great and live this perfect life or whatever. And the majority of the time, that's not true. We're all just normal people. Just some people either have better luck or just more talented at certain things than other people. And so I think that was a really good, just like, you know, metaphor of what it's like to be human, where we all want this intrinsic, you know, path and this, you know, idea that we're special. And, you know, 99% of the time, that's, you know, not the truth at all. I like the relationship, I guess the hologram relationship. I thought the interesting thing about that was just, he's pretty much projecting what the humans are projecting onto him. He's projecting onto her, where it's just like this kind of fake relationship where he has the, you know, upper hand just because he actually has, you know, flesh and she just lights and all that. And so I thought that was kind of interesting too, where you kind of see the same thing, which is like people treat each other, where, you know, one class treats themselves better than the one below it, and it just kind of cascades down just because you're going, you're kind of up the other way in the ladder. So it was, those are like the four things that really grabbed me. But I think my favorite scene too was, you see all this just like just rain and muck and just grossness, and they show that shot of the forest of the, you know, girl making all the memories. Like, I'm such a hippie now, where like my brain, if I like you know, see an image of nature like that, and it's like all of a sudden I feel so much better. Like I have this huge dopamine rush. I was like, oh, you know, that's so nice to see after all this just wet and muck throughout the movie. I know that you talked a lot about, you know, filmmaking. Was there anything that you liked that this director did specifically in the remake? And you think it paid enough homage to the one before it while still doing its own thing?
Sure. Oh, yeah. You know, when this movie, this has been one of those things in Hollywood, any popular movie that has any modicum of success, even movies that are just a cult classic now, get either remakes or sequels. But all that starts not long after the original came out. So there's been rumors about a Blade Runner sequel or prequel or this or that for many, many, many years. Would Harrison Ford be involved? Would he not be involved? Would Ridley Scott direct it? Would he not direct it? And Ridley Scott was attached to it for a while and then eventually left the project. And that's my brain is tied up about that when it was going on, because I love Ridley Scott. He did the original, but he's not who he used to be. And I'm just like, is it blasphemous for me to say that Ridley probably isn't the best guy to direct the Blade Runner sequel when he masterfully directed the first one? And I just something happens to directors. You know, for me, movies are about directors. A lot of people, it's actors or just, you know, the genre or whatever. For me, it's all about directors. And there's just something that happens. There's very few guys who are just excellent going forward. I mean, Marty Scorsese, I love his early work. He's got a couple of good movies here and there, but for the most part, I don't enjoy his later stuff. Steven Spielberg completely went off a cliff. You know, I love Stanley Kubrick. A lot of people didn't like his last movie. I wasn't a big fan of that one either. He sort of just at the very end, a lot of people feel like just, you know, sort of smeared his otherwise almost flawless filmography with Eyes Wide Shut. So something happens with these directors later in life. So I was not in favor of the remake. Or I was not in favor, I'm sorry, of the sequel or the remake. Just leave it alone. Then when Ridley was involved, I thought, well, maybe it'll be good. And then when he got fired, at first I was mad, and I thought, well, let's see who they name. And the guy they got, I thought, was the perfect guy to do it. I think he did a good job. There were some homages. One funny one, kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier about the failed swings in the original that didn't come to fruition. One of them was, of course, at the time, in 1982 when the movie was made, 81, 82 when it was made, Atari was a big deal, so they had these giant Atari billboards.
Yeah.
Well, in the second one, they went ahead and continued with the mistaken, you know, continuance of the Atari empire, which I thought was kind of cool. But yeah, the whole movie had tons and tons of nods to the original. That whole scene that I love that they had another scene take place, you know, similar to the original, where the Sean Young character that Deckard eventually falls in love with, you know, he notices the owl. He asks her if the owl is real. And she says, you know, she says it doesn't. What did she say? Anyway, there's that whole thing that goes on there. And that's that one where the light is like the room is lit with the rippling water. So they have that whole scene with Jared Leto that has that sort of same setting. I mean, there were. I got to say, for a guy who was very skeptical going in, and I didn't really like the first trailer. The second trailer I liked a lot. I started feeling more positive about it. I went in with very low expectations and came away pretty impressed.
Yeah, and they do the same thing with the owl. Whenever he has the dog, he asks if his dog's real, and he goes, what do you think, or whatever. Yeah, it's pretty.
Yeah, or doesn't
way.
Matter. I think.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to ask another question for you, but you finish what you're saying.
Yeah. I just wanted to before it leaves my head. The big thing in the sequel that was unspoken that I just don't feel like a lot of people are talking about, or maybe I just completely missed something, is, you know, if you know anything about Blade Runner, you know that the definitive edition, I believe, is the director's cut, which a lot of times, just FYI, director cut, when you hear that, director's cut, that's a marketing thing. Like, that's just so they can sell more DVDs. It doesn't actually typically mean that the director sat down and laid out his vision for the final cut of the movie, because famously, the original theatrical cut of Blade Runner was not Ridley Scott's final vision. The director's cut actually had his final vision for the movie, which laid it out that Deckard, the Harrison Ford character, was in fact a replicant. Well, in the second movie, he's the father of this replicant child, and they just sort of leave it hanging, like, wait a minute, he is a replicant. How, like, they don't explain the science of how this child was conceived. It was just sort of hanging out there. Like, it was just like this, you know, immaculate conception, and it was just sort of left in the background of the movie setting, I think, as a big mystery as to how this actually happened. It wasn't about the how, it was about, you know, at the end getting him to her.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. I didn't think, because after I saw it, I really didn't tie it together with the first one really whatsoever. But yeah, that makes exact sense. And also, I guess, has the idea too with, you know, the idea of true love, where like you're supposed to meet somebody at a specific time in a specific place to do, you know, a specific thing or whatever. And I didn't have a kind of call back to the idea as well too.
Yeah, so I'm very glad that you got something out of the themes of it and just, you know, more than the, I think a lot of people, like I said, when it comes to sci-fi, they're either not into the genre or they don't appreciate what is essentially a drama wrapped in science fiction. It's not, you know what I mean? It's just it's basically a setting. The science fiction is a setting. And I love movies like that when they're done well.
Yeah. And the whole idea, I guess, when you tell a story is that though your narrative or, you know, the segment you choose, it's just the best way to tell the story. It's not that you're trying to, you know, say, I want to write a stream of consciousness story. It's that you have this this plot, this narrative, and this is the best way to tell it. And you're not trying to force one the other. I think that is kind of similar to what you're saying, too. And I guess the one question I have, you know, after I finished watching it, is I guess kind of what happens after. So Harrison Ford, you know, meets his daughter, and then it seems like Ryan Gosling may have died. And then, or at the very minimum, you know, all these Blade Runners will be chasing him and, you know, probably all three of them. So what do you think happens after this movie ends?
Good question. I do think Ryan Gosling's character died. I think, you know, they were purposely vague about it. I just think that's a thing that filmmakers like to do these days, which is leave some things vague that shouldn't be. I don't think that's necessarily the situation here. I'm fine with the vagueness. Like I said, there's so much about the end of that movie that was kind of vague, but it was also weirdly emotionally satisfying at the end. A huge upset, of course, is that Harrison Ford's character survives the movie. I mean, that I don't think anyone would have bet that, you know, he would have come back for yet another role in a franchise playing an older version of himself and actually not be killed in the movie. I fully expected him to sacrifice himself and die at some point, but it ended up being the other way around. So that was sort of a nice surprise. I was just sort of expecting the same old Hollywood formulaic schlock, I guess. But yeah, as far as what happens afterward, the big question, I guess, is, and see, I didn't even think about this after the movie, but a friend of mine brought this question to my attention. And it's, did the, you know, there was that segment of the story that was like that, you know, the replican uprising. They were all sort of organizing to take over.
Yeah.
Did they know that the Harrison Ford daughter was who she was? Did they already know that? That, to me, would drive the rest of the story, because I think that you could work yourself into a nice little twist there that maybe they actually knew about her and were, you know, trying to suss out her location. I think they really could. I don't generally like sequels that pick up right where the previous movie left off. And I know they're not going to do that with this, but I think they could do a lot with just that storyline alone.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess also too, whenever they have the two replicant prostitutes, they're like, hey, go talk to, you know, him or whatever. Mm-hmm. It seemed like, I don't know what she knew or whatever, that why, you know, Ryan Gosling would be the right person to choose. Or maybe they knew that she put that memory inside of him, and so he's the one to contact to get him going to be able to try to find the girl. And I guess it kind of goes back the other way too with the whole Jared Leto and that Mia Android deal, where, you know, she's helping him out so he can be on the hunt to find out where this girl is. So maybe there's some along there in those lines where they know where these like who's creating the memories, where maybe they're being placed in. They have the information, and now it's trying to get Harrison Ford back with her, but also. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe to like untap all of her potential, maybe, or get the full story, and then, you know, lead this, I guess, uprising or pulling it or making a new version of replicants one way or the other.
Yeah, that's where it gets clouded. They could go so many different directions from there. And I don't even know where I would go as a former attempted screenwriter, but there's a lot of meat on the bone there if they wanted to continue pursuing it. You know, the movie, unfortunately, was a horrendous flop. So chances of there being another one are probably pretty low. But, I mean, shit, they've made The Punisher 3 times, and those are all disasters. You know, they keep making Batman movies. And, you know, the ones for DC they're not total box office disasters, but they're not huge hits either. So I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe, but this kind of sci-fi, I just don't think with that, the combination of the type of sci-fi it is with the fact that it was a complete flop, I'm sure that's the last we've seen, probably at least in my lifetime.
Yeah, my joke was after the movie was over is that in 2047, we'll get Blade Runner 2079, and it's going to be a very good movie.
Yeah.
And I can't wait for it.
And it was pretty cool. Like, the last time I watched the original, it's probably been about a year or so, maybe 2 years. And I never noticed it before, but I was paying attention to, there's a scene where, like, they show, you know, the replicants that are sort of the bad guys, into the Rucker Hauer, the Daryl Hannah character that are in that movie. And they have, like, a screen on that little kitschy little computer screen that shows when they entered service versus, like, the movie
cool.
takes place in 2019. And the day that the Rucker Hauer, Roy Batty character entered service was like literally a week away from the day that I was watching the movie the last time. It was like sometime in 2015 or 2016.
Yeah.
So it got me like all charged up about Blade Runner again.
Yeah. That's
Which
awesome.
Is probably about when I started, you know, calling you slanderer of Blade Runner.
Yeah, that's pretty cool though. I read, you know, Who Dreams of Electric Sheep, and I thought, or Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? Yeah, I'm stupid. And I read that. I thought that was fine. You know, I think science fiction is a much better thing to watch, because I love watching science fiction movies. Reading it's a little bit different. Like, I love Moon. I love this a lot. There's a lot of them that I love Ex Machina too. Like, the last like three recent ones that I saw, I really have enjoyed. So whenever they come out, I get really excited for it. Always, you know, bums me out when they aren't that great. But yeah, I really love this movie. If you haven't seen it, you should. Chris, if you were to give this movie a rating, how many stars would you give it out of five?
I'd probably go 4 out of 5. If we're not doing halves, I'd probably go 4 out of 5.
Yeah, I think so too.
I mean,
I think five out of five is like a life changing event, you know?
Yeah. I might dip. If we do halves, I might go down to 3.5. Because yeah, I reserve my fives for, you know, if there's more than one or two 5-star movies in a decade, you know, starting from, like, I don't know, say the 2000s and the 2010s so far, I bet you I don't have any more than four 5-star movies in that entire span. So I usually reserve that for the ones that really blow your hair back.
Yeah. I would give it 4.5 stars. And like I said, there's like four things that really stuck with me. There is, you know, two scenes that I just love, that Elvis fight scene, that, you know, the nature shot when she's making those memories. Those things just, you know, I loved a whole lot. And like, it kept me entertained the entire time. Usually for me, like, my baseline if a movie's good or not is whether or not I fall asleep in it. If I stay awake through the entire movie, I'm like, yeah, that's a really good movie. I really enjoyed that. I got the third Planet of the Apes I saw this summer. I slept for 30 minutes. I'm like, yeah, the movie was terrible. And that's kind of how my ranking system goes. So there's four things I really loved. I stayed awake through the entire movie. You know, it was great. I want to see it again in theaters too, because it's just a really beautiful movie too to watch. And so if you haven't seen it in theaters, you really have to.
Yeah. Check out Arrival if you haven't seen it. I'm not a huge fan of the plot and the story necessarily. Like, I like the idea of it, but I didn't really like the execution of it. But the cinematography is, you know, I mean, it's great. The cinematography in Blade Runner is better, but the cinematography in Arrival is pretty great.
Yeah. And I guess going back to what you're saying too, like, I love Sicario. He made Sicario. And like, I love border stuff. I love, you know, cartel movies. I love, you know, that Western violence and that sort of things. And that, same thing with that movie, like, there's just some just spectacular parts in that. And that whole movie is just kind of like it's, I think it means a lot, but it's also a lot of fun. Like, there's a lot of really good action in it and a lot of really good performances in that one. It's by the same director. And Sicario, like, was really under the radar too. Like, I thought it was being nominated. It wasn't. Nobody really talked about it. Nobody really has since, but Sicario is, you know, awesome.
Yeah, Sicario was great. I was greatly looking forward to that one when it came out. And yeah, I agree. I felt like the critical response was a little not as good as I expected. I mean, it was a pretty good critically acclaimed movie, but I didn't really hear people fawning over it. And I was a little bit surprised that it completely missed the award season. But I guess you also have to factor in when it was released. I don't remember what time of year it was released, but if it was released early in the year, then that probably, you know, sunk it, unless it was just a 5-star potential type of movie, which it's pretty close to for me.
Yeah, it was released about the same time 2 years ago, because I remember I was living in Virginia. I saw The Martian and I saw Sicario back to back, and that was a good doubleheader. Okay. And it rained a lot that day. Yeah, that was a good time.
Yeah. Have you? I mean, we could do this all night. But you said you like border stuff, cartel stuff. I assume you've watched the Narcos on Netflix.
Yeah, I watched season one, and it was fun. I liked the language in it. It was a fun movie to watch.
I'm a big fan of the guy who plays Pablo Escobar. Interesting bit of trivia on Pablo Escobar. He's Brazilian. He's actually Brazilian and did not speak a lick of Spanish. He spoke Portuguese. So he had to learn that entire language. So I just think he is fantastic as Pablo Escobar. Like, to me, he's the best part of that show. I found out after the fact that he didn't know that language at all. Like, he had to completely learn it from the ground up, and then I was even more impressed.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I guess he's in season two. I heard season three, they already have Escobar, so I should probably go back and watch season two for that. But all my border stuff is just coming from going to West Texas as many times I have. And then Cormac McCarthy with The Blood Meridian, No Country for Old Men, then his border trilogy. And just like, the landscape is kind of, and like, you can just like walk right in Mexico in the park, away forever if you want to. And so that's kind of stuff I want from that. The violence and all that and the drug war stuff, all that's terrible, but it adds, plot to that landscape. There's like a perfect like mesh of just like awful and just beauty,
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. Anything shot in a harsh environment, it always sort of captures my imagination.
Yeah. Well, that was a lot of fun. I think we've talked long enough. On Twitter, after this is over, you should tweet out your 5-star movies for me. So maybe during the bye week or on a rainy day, I can have something to pay $5 and rent on Amazon Prime whenever I have some free time. And I'm sure if anybody else is listening tonight who is still listening, if there's 5 of you, 6 of you, whatever, I'm sure they'd be interested too.
Cool. Yeah, I'll do it for sure.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on tonight, Chris. I missed you. I don't know anybody else has, but it was great having you on. I know we've spent a lot of time talking about the Texans together, so it was good having you on tonight, having your BFD as well. I think it's like a year and a half since we've all talked about the Texans, so it wasn't the best to talk Texans football, but it all worked out really well. Thank you for the questions live, everybody who asked them. I know we missed one or two because we got into the Blade Runner stuff, and I didn't want to circumvent that conversation. But if you listen live and you like the show, tell your friends. That's the best way to spread the show. We don't do the show for listens, but for love. But as many people as we can get to enjoy it is always a good thing. And we'll be back on live next week. I don't know if it's be Monday or Tuesday. I kind of want to get Luke on maybe on a Monday and do kind of like a bi-week preview and talk, or bi-week review and talk about the Seahawks game some. But it all just kind of depends. But anyway, thanks for listening tonight live or recorded. Thanks for being on tonight, Chris. Weston, thanks for listening to All Red Radio.
Thanks, Matt.
Sounded good to me. I thought it was pretty good.